This is a 3CR podcast.
And this is Published or Not.
Mischance Creek is the title of Gary Dish's latest novel featuring Senior Constable Paul Hirschhausen. And it's a novel where the first principles of police work, dogged routine, is more important than the chance or luck suggested in the title. So, Gary, welcome back to 3CR.
Thanks, David.
I can't help but think you have a microcosm of Australia represented here in the seemingly backwater of Tiverton in South Australia. Now, where is that exactly? Who is Hirsch? Because we've come across him before. We need to flesh him out a bit. And what's the mundane task he's got that sets this novel going?
Well, the backstory is Hirsch was a young detective in Adelaide, but the CIB squad was corrupt and some of the mud stuck to him, so he was demoted to uniform and sent to a one-officer police station about halfway between Adelaide and the Flinders Ranges, perhaps 3 hours north of Adelaide. It's dry wheat and wool country. And as the only policeman in the district, his tasks range from attending serious crimes, but also the mundane. And in this book, in the midst of a terrible drought, he's going from farmhouse to farmhouse, checking on weapons, that they're licensed, that they're safely secured, that the ammunition's secured separately.
But it's bureaucratic.
Well, I wanted to show, I didn't want a hero to leap onto the stage fully formed in the first page and encounters a murder in the second page. This is a country cop whose job is as much bureaucratic work, like checking on gun licenses, as it is checking on an elderly widow with a schizophrenic son on a back road and attending at crime scenes.
But that checking of guns also has a social function as well.
Yes, these are lonely backcountry people. They love it when he arrives because they invite him in for a cup of tea. So by the end of the day, he's probably had 20 cups of tea and stale biscuits. But it's a lifeline for these people. And in many ways for him too. He's keeping a check on the people who live in an area probably, you know, half the size of France.
But this simple task also leads to a clue emerging that he's not even aware is a clue, some .22 rifle shells belonging to Alistair Stanier.
Yeah, Alistair Stanier is the rather sad, overlooked younger son of a wealthy farmer. And in my plotting, I like to light a fuse, several fuses along the way. They might seem irrelevant, that reader might pass over them, but they explode further along in the story. So those 22 caliber shells that he sees in the dirt at Alistair Stanier's house reverberate further down the book.
And we find out why later, but we won't give that away. But now we get a gradual escalation because the behaviour of some of these residents actually reflect an underlying social turmoil. What's going on at the local school?
I do like to layer my books with wider events in society that have an influence on us all. And the drought, poverty, lack of jobs in country areas, all those sorts of things. But I've been doing a lot of research during COVID and since into some of the groups that have emerged as a result of that. The anti-vaxxers, the far right, which I deal with in the previous Hirsch novel, and the sovereign citizen movement. At first it seemed these were oddballs. There would be newspaper stories, because I had dozens of clippings, of a country cop like Hirsch pulling over a driver who's got dodgy number plates. And the driver will insist, your rules don't apply to me. I'm a sovereign citizen. I can drive on the roads of Terra Australis without a licence, without registering my car, without insurance. Your laws don't apply to me. So, but it's always seemed to me that there's the potential there for violence. And I have to insist that the book was written, edited, printed and in the warehouses before Desi Freeman murdered those two policemen 2 or 3 months ago. So certainly there is violence there. And I've heard since that a lot of magistrates and judges, because sovereign citizens are always appearing before them, have been receiving death threats.
I'm just wondering, though, because what you've got in this backdrop in this country town, but it's happening across Australia in many ways, is a sense of disenfranchisement. So even the school has its problems because government has made a decision to amalgamate, which it causes frustration. So there are decisions being made beyond our control. Yeah.
I'd like to remind the reader of that just an ordinary citizen going about their day-to-day life, or a policeman like Hirsch, they are subject to rules that are passed either in the capital city of that state, or from Canberra, or even from New York, Washington. These laws, these movements, these ways of looking at the world affect us all. And in a country town like the one I portray, there are no jobs for young men and young women. They might marry each other, but that doesn't help anything. And so there is a sense of disenfranchisement, and one avenue of relief for them is to go down the rabbit holes of strange beliefs in the internet, which answer some of their questions, which empower them in some way.
Well, it also can lead to violence. So Hirsch is actually attacked.
Yeah, that... not only does he get a punch in the guts from this young father at the school gates, but further down the track, the police station comes under siege.
And you wonder what leads people to actually think they can go that far, because it's now almost, well, I won't say commonplace, but people are pushing the edges.
Yeah, they certainly are. And it's led, I think, to an increased tension and anxiety around even demonstrations in Melbourne here, that, or the recent Nazi display in Sydney, that these gatherings are going to get much more violent in the future, I think.
And yet Sergeant Brandle, who's Hirsch's immediate superior, has a policy of, well, we can try and disrupt Trent's pathways. What does she mean by this? What's she advocating?
Oh, she went to a conference that is aimed at helping police officers interrupt the pathways of a young man or young woman who've perhaps committed a petty crime, but there's the risk there that they'll go on to commit further crimes. So if the police can intervene, play a sort of a social welfare role, it might guide them back on course.
Well, there was a time when that did work, you know, your local copper would take you aside, but now it's getting harder and harder. But you then escalate things even further. There's a nice little quote here: the past persisted, the place was imprinted with it. In addition to the colonial past, there was the recent past, 10-year-old wind farm turbines strung along a nearby ridgeline, and the long indigenous past, Ngadjiri rock art. There's also Hirsch's past. So the country itself has a past, and you bring up the indigenous issue as well.
It's all part of the way I look at these things, I suppose. I trained as a historian, and to my shame, I knew nothing about the indigenous past of the wheat and wool farm I grew up in the mid-north of South Australia. It's only in the last 10 or 20 years that I've done research into it. We had no knowledge of it as kids, and our parents didn't either. My grandfather had a grinding stone that had been found on the paddock, but he didn't bother to understand who might have left it there.
And how, well, what its past was as well. But it all builds the fabric, but here we go again. The past and the present then overlap with a cold case that emerges. Annika Nordrum is looking for clues regarding to the death of her father and disappearance of her mother, who'd been fossicking in the area. What's suspicious about this case?
The daughter... arrives 6 years later. This disappearance happened before Hirsch was even posted to the area, and he gets intrigued by talking to her, and she is clearly of the opinion that the original police case was underdone, and Hirsch finds the old records in the filing cabinet of the police station, and he agrees that more could have been done, and he starts to help her. But you know, I am drawing on some obvious tropes about the outback, that the outback is, we can relate it to loss and disappearance and peril.
Well, that's a trope now that's become part of the Australian mythology, if you like. And so there's a connection with something in the Northern Territory. And you think, my goodness, what's going on here? The other curious thing about this case, the Nordrums, the dog, as in what the evidence that gets twisted around the dog, the finding of the dog, who owns it, all sorts of things, which has been misinterpreted.
Yeah. It's just, it's at one level, it's me playing tricks with the reader. I get them to focus on the wrong issue, and that the dog and its collar are quite vital. But in the end, in the beginning, it just seems this is a wandering dog.
Yeah, well, it belonged to the Nordrums, but people were telling different stories about where they got the dog from, where they left the dog, who got it in the first place, which changes then the chain of evidence, if you want to put it that way, which is unravelled. So there are suspicions about the case. The father, Ben, is found at the bottom of a mine shaft. Nothing unusual about that, but how did it occur? But then we also have some rather dodgy dealings with the local council. And we can't actually go into full detail about this and to give too much away, but it's also something in Victoria's recent past. And so how much are you relying on events that are happening in the news to sort of inform your storytelling?
I think I rely on it quite a bit. If it's just a one-off, then I might use it in a different way. But from my newspaper clippings file from over several years, I've been seeing more and more instances of the government stepping in because a local council's been badly run and putting in administrators, of councillors being arrested for corruption, bribery, whatever it might be, and of sovereign citizens invading council meetings, so they've had to bring in armed guards. So it seems to me it was something I can legitimately draw on and to try and understand what is happening in local government and why are there pressures and where are the pressures coming from.
But it's happening within communities right across Australia, this sense of disenfranchisement. But the interesting thing is Clarissa Stanier is the mayor, married to that property owner, Mitchell Stanier, whose brother is Alexander Stanier.
Yeah, the black sheep, younger
the
brother.
The black sheep, where the 20.22 shell casings came from. But I don't want to justify what Trent McRae does, but is that going down the rabbit hole understandable then, given that those levels of what we used to rely on, the local bureaucracy, the government's making decisions, all that disenfranchisement, is it understandable?
Perhaps it is, because I think there's been a slip or an ebbing away of respect for nurses, doctors, ambulance officials, police, teachers.
Teachers, yes.
So that seems to be general across the board. So if there's a lack of respect for old-time authority, people like Trent in the book are looking for other answers.
Yes, because
other so-called father figures, if you like, too.
Yeah, ways, direction, which he falls into, but he falls in with the wrong people, which leads then to the solving of this cold case revelation about corruption in the local council, and everything remarkably comes together. It's quite a web that you have woven here of past and present. So the book is Mischance Creek. Nothing chancy about it in terms of how it's all put together. The author is Gary Disher, and it is a text publishing release. So, Gary, thank you very much for talking with me again today.
Thanks, David.
Well, my book could be a historical fiction or an Australian saga of seven generations. Louisa, the 13-year-old convict, was the first of the family to come to Victoria. Then there's the sixth and the seventh generation, Liesl and her daughter Else. But it is so much more than just the past we go into. It could also be close to our future. Rose Michael has written such a believable sci-fi titled Else. Welcome back, Rose.
Thanks very much for having me, Jen.
I said that it was close to now, but also close to Melbourne. Where is the Ninch?
The Ninch is a name that the locals give for the Mornington Peninsula, the skinny strip of land that reaches out on the right-hand crab claw of Port Phillip Bay.
And another quote from the book, where the peninsula's crooked finger hooked wild water in. You give us a map, and this has important sites. The back beach where Harold Holt drowned, the quarantine station, and the defence fort at the very end. What was the significance that the lime kiln gave to these generations?
The lime kiln and the research into the lime kiln on the Ninch was something that came later throughout the book. So I started with the contemporary story. And it was really as they moved towards this family home, and it was thinking through the materials that the house would have been made at. And because I have this access to the place, walking around, looking at these old houses, and actually identifying, just from a total kind of layperson's point of view, the similarity between the material of the house and actually the cliffs that I was walking on, you know, and the things that sort of were like petrified tree roots or sandstone, starting to recognise that there was actually this lime in the area, and then looking into the research. So I had sort of assumed it was farming country. I knew that it was sort of biodiverse. I literally didn't know what the backstory was of that area. And then going to the Sorrento Museum and you're having these quite hilarious encounters with maps that said there were 20 people living in the area, some blind spots there. But actually looking at this industry, which I knew nothing about, and as a fiction writer it just seemed like a metaphor, this idea of creating lime and what the lime could do. And this was one of the, you know, the first businesses was shipping this lime
for building.
To build cities.
The title of the book is Else, and that's also the name of Liesl's daughter. Liesl grew someone else's baby. This is a quote. Her womb as a cuckoo chosen nest, home to a daughter who would inherit neither her mother's neurosis, her grandma's suicidal tendencies, or great-grand's debatable disposition. So it's all this story, this nature-nurture argument yet again. But what was Liesl's neurosis?
I guess Liesl, the mother character in the book, her diagnosis is never given, whether she had a diagnosis or not. But she's a technical editor. She's got a science, a pseudoscience, an adjacent science background. And she recognises her fixations and obsessions and interests, and she, you know, is very struck by, I guess, things like seasonal affective disorder and this continual puzzlement around what is normal, what is normative. And so while she understands that she's anxious, that she's depressed, that she possibly presents as bipolar, these aspects, she basically thinks, aren't we all? Isn't everybody like this? Isn't this actually these fluctuations and these neurotic tendencies, isn't that being human?
Of course she's trying to normalise her daughter, who else, who isn't coping in the sensory overloaded world. Well, the story starts with Liesl being phoned to collect 13-year-old daughter from school. Why?
Because the rain has not stopped, because the floods have risen and are at the school gates.
After 7 years of drought, a month of extreme rain and a once-in-200-year storm, and this I'm going to get Rose Michael to read a little bit.
Water is still pouring up and over and through crescents and courts, caravan parks and golf courses, opening old ways in time-worn bedrock. Long-lost creeks, returning, have only jimmied open crevices and cracks, emptying out with the force of their push and rush, stream beds filled in at settlement, starting to sprout marine seeds dormant for decades, as good as any gene bank, hatching aquatic eggs that have waited centuries for this, just the right conditions.
So, of course, this flood is terrible for some. but good for others, and terrible for Liesl because she has to get out of the family home. So she makes her way, a difficult journey, to the White House on the Ninch. Now, we think about rain, but it's warm rain. It's hot rain. It's coming tropical rain. And they get to the White House and they think they're okay and we think they're going to be safe there, but they can't stay. Why?
Well, there's two answers to that. One is the plot answer, but my inclination is actually to answer it as a writer. I saw Tony Burch speak, it was probably last year or something, and he talked about wish fulfillment. And I think I wrote this story wanting to find a safe place, wanting to find a place of refuge, wanting to find an alternative to some of the mainstream, you know, neoliberal transactional economies that we seem quite sort of fixed in. And at every turn, imagining that safety wasn't guaranteed or that it was a disengagement from aspects of life that we still need to keep engaging with. So from a plot point of view, the house is not on high enough ground.
No, they've got to get out. And this is a quote, because it's falling down around them. Plasterboard, paint decay, peels away doors, too swollen to close became too swollen to open. So Alice is showing capabilities. She's strong, stoic, and built for this, her mother thinks. And she finds the convenience of wearing a wetsuit. So it's good in all conditions. Don't have to change clothes. So they have to get to higher ground, as the water is now 50 metres higher and not subsiding. Now I'm going to ask Michael to read more about water.
April filled dams that May overflowed. June had animals noisy with delight. By July, the whole south was officially awash. And then comes this, August. Tidal flooding might not be so pronounced during East Coast lows, but flash floods are more than the last straw, and then and now more water comes from an other direction. A hurricane is on its way.
And not only that, it's Antarctica as well. There's water, water, water. As they plod on, Alice asks for stories. And what are the stories or facts that Liesl gives?
So one of the things I was playing with in this book, and actually I've played with in all my books from the first book that was called The Asking Game, is how conversation works, how it works on the page, how it works within individuals. And as I've learnt more about neurodiversity, you know, I'm really struck by the fact that one of the aspects that's often identified with an autistic diagnosis is that conversation is a social construct that isn't necessarily understood intuitively by all people. And I now see that as something that I've, you know, am very consciously kind of engaged with. And in this instance of this example in this story, the mother and daughter relationship is something that I am really engaging with, how that connection might happen that is not captured in language or is not captured in a normal or normative conversation. And so what I see these women as doing is exchanging stories, exchanging animal facts, exchanging observations about the environment, and that this is actually a kind of connection and a kind of really genuine exchange between them that is potentially deeper than saying, how did you sleep? How's your day? And yet I think it's odd, you know, it's odd, like when you're making small talk in the lift and somebody says something that's actually meaningful.
The animals, though, that Liesl talks about,
yeah,
they are so adaptable in their mating habits and their survival. And I think it's the facts of life, but it's other animal life, not just human animal life. And also the way you've written it in quite poetic forms.
Thank you. This was actually where the book started, with animal observations on the Mornington Peninsula, you know, and I work as a researcher as well. And, you know, I think about creative practice, about writing, as a way of engaging with, you know, what it is to be in the world, to process that living in the world. And the fact is, it's not just humans in the world. And so that actually that sort of poetic observation is a way of engaging with these more than human, you know, with the non-human animals that we travel alongside, that are part of our environment. And at every point, I mean, I guess it's like what I was saying with the sort of the limestone research, the closer you get, the more you go into that inquiry, the more relevant everything seems connected. Everything seems to be an example, an image, an analogy for our connection or disconnection from the environment. Everything is kind of manifest sort of somewhere else, and we just have to open our eyes to see it.
You talked about animals travelling, and that's exactly what Liesl and Els do. They pick up two Australian animals.
That's right. In fact, I've been thinking a little bit, as you get the distance from having written the book and published the book, and you start to think what it's like from a reader's point of view, kind of coming in, not having the 7 years of living in the story. One of the things that I really think about is that it's about the pack. It's about finding a new pack, finding a pack where you fit, making your own pack. And so, yeah, they travel together, and that these animals are not pets. And they are not different from them, only in the same way that Liesl and Els are different from each other.
Well, in the flood, it's the insects who are bound. And then the dingo picks up a change of climate.
That's right. I guess the flood that starts the book is not the only weather event, massive weather event. And you know, I was writing part of this book in 2020, and, you know, during the bushfires, and I was down on the Mornington Peninsula, and there was smoke in the garden from the Sydney fires, you know, and it was an experience, you know, unlike anything that me or my kids had experienced before, to be in our, you know, pristine beach environment, and yet to have the day, you know, turn to night, and to have ash on your skin.
Her dad explains to Liesl the butterfly effect, the smallest beat of minuscule wings somewhere, changing weather somewhere else. Could it go the other way? Could Mother Nature shrug us off the end? Look, a great book. Liesl and her daughter Els are awkward in society, but in the demands of a climatic crisis, they find their capabilities more attuned to their changing environment, one in which other animals have adaptions and techniques to survive. Els is a book set in the not-so-distant future by Rose Michael. What a read.
Thanks so much, Jan.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au. You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.